Good.
Heavenly Father, today we put on the full armor to protect us against attack. We put on the belt of truth to protect against lies and deception. We put on the breastplate of righteousness to protect our hearts from the temptations. We put the gospel of peace on our feet to walk in your light, peace, and freedom with the Holy Spirit. We rebuke anxious thoughts. We take up your shield of faith for protection to block and destroy all the darts and threats thrown at us by the enemy. We put on the helmet of salvation to cover our minds and thoughts, reminding us that we are children of a mighty King. We are forgiven, set free, saved by the blood of Jesus. We take up the sword of the Spirit, your living word, that has the power to demolish strongholds and is sharper than any double-edged sword. We come to you, Lord, in prayer daily. In Jesus' mighty name we pray. Amen. What's up, you guys? Welcome to The Imagination. I'm your host, Emma, and this week I'm honored to introduce to you someone that I was introduced to recently through independent investigative reporter and journalist Kathy Fox, and someone who has undoubtedly had a tremendous impact on my own journey learning about the hard truths of the world. Introducing MKUltra survivor and whistleblower, blogger, author, writer, educator, and selfless advocate, Anne Diamond. An original whistleblower of our time, Anne was one of the first to publicly whistleblow MKUltra and has since given a voice to countless victims and courage to countless survivors of government-sanctioned abuse of all kinds. Anne's story begins in the 1950s in Canada, where she was sold into the MKUltra projects as a child to prolific MKUltra programmer Dr. Donald Ewing Cameron of McGill University. In Anne's words, quote, "The story of MKUltra in Canada has never been properly told. It was a pan-Canadian phenomenon, not limited to Montreal and Dr. Cameron. In the early 60s, much of what had been a McGill University program was gradually transferred to Toronto, specifically to York University and an emerging counterculture scene that became a breeding ground for many Fabian and Tavistock influenced movements and programs. Saskatchewan was another center for MKUltra mind control, about which very little has been written. Unfortunately, Canada's publishing industry is very much a product of that covert expansion of MKUltra throughout Canada. Books like Ann Collins' The Sleep Room presented a partial account but failed to get at the roots in British eugenics and Nazi psychiatry or hint at the vastness of this program, which was secretly promoted at the highest levels of our establishment," unquote. In this episode this week, you guys will hear Anne's amazing testimony surrounding MKUltra and her involvement in Project Monarch, deep dives into some notable and suspicious connections she had in her life, including Canadian singer, songwriter, poet, and novelist Leonard Cohen, as well as some recent updates and information from her personal life. Anne's voice has been a crucial part of why podcasts like mine are able to exist to begin with, and I want to give a special thank you to Anne for her courage to continue forward after all these years so the children of tomorrow can have a better future than the children of the past and of today. We are so grateful for the work you've done to pave the way to where we are today, Anne. So you guys, without further ado, please help me in welcoming walking miracle, whistleblower, overcomer, and all-around inspiration, the one, the only, Anne Diamond. Anne, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Wow, I'm flabbergasted. I almost fainted. That was great. I have to tell my friends about
my I love writing the intros. It's so nice to finally meet you. Like I said, you had such a big impact on me when I was waking up from my slumber with, you know, learning about the world. And it's such an honor to finally have you on. And I know a lot of people that listen, they might be a little bit newer to your story, and that's awesome because we're going to dive into it today. But I wanted to say, how awesome is it now that people are finally interested in this for you? I mean, I can't imagine what it was like in the early 2000s trying to talk about this. You know, that has to feel so good for you.
Yeah, I think something's changed for sure. Certainly, nobody was asking me to do podcasts, and I couldn't even get anyone to read my book, you know. And, you know, and the other, another thing I remember about that time was that when I would talk about it to people who were, you know, who said, "What are you writing about? And what is this story?" I would shake. It was so, it was so intense for me that my voice would change and I'd start to just kind of shake, you know, vibrate. And I thought, you know, I'm not really, I don't think I'm ready for, you know, to go out of the house with this because it's so intense. And also when you have the feeling that nobody knows what you're talking about and therefore nobody will believe you, it just adds another layer to the, you know, some of it is just going through trauma, is reliving trauma as you remember and try to talk about it. And some of it is knowing that there's nobody, you know, no one who'll understand except other survivors who were out there at that time. I was not the first one or anything. I had people like Carol Rutz, you know, and Kathy O'Brien, of course, and so many. Lynn Sharman, you know, in Ontario. And so, yeah, but it has really broadened now, and it seems to be something you can actually talk about. Voice.
Yes, and you have people like you.
Sorry?
Yeah. I said, and you have people like you who are writing blogs and books, and people like Kathy O'Brien who have a film. And I think one person at a time, just over the years, it's getting out there to more and more people, and they're finding you more easy, you know. And gosh, back in the early 2000s, trying to figure out, you know, where other survivors are. I mean, that had to have been a whole different world. It's hard now to research stuff, and we have everything at our disposal. That had to have been just a really neat process for you over the years to just see the difference now versus how it was then.
Yeah, I hope that's true, because I know that when I started, and it was in 2003, really, that I really started. And I would read for like 10, 12 hours a day sometimes, because there was a lot on the internet, but it was kind of, you could find whole documents, you could find conference papers, you know, transcripts from all kinds of stuff was there. I'm not sure some of that hasn't been taken down now, because I don't go back and review it all. I mean, I took it all in at the time, but I hope it's true. I mean, I think it has become more general. I hope they're not deleting and erasing the evidence and something that everyone worries about, you know?
Absolutely. Yes. But that's why voices like yours are so important, because you are the evidence, you know, and you have that information within you, within your mind and in your heart that you can express to people, and they don't need articles now, you know, and I love that.
Yeah, maybe that's true.
And so let's get into your story a little bit. Let's maybe start, either you could start at the beginning or wherever you want, but I'd love to paint the picture for people. Your testimony is incredible. And like I said, you've been speaking out about it for decades now. So I'd love for you to share with people who might be newer, and we can start wherever you want and just kind of flow through, and I'll give you space to talk.
Okay. And feel free to interrupt me, because I can go on and on. And
okay. I'm sure I'll have some questions.
It's much harder to write a whole book than it is easier to write a book than it is to write a little blurb in many ways, you know? So you just didn't feel free to interrupt, because I guess I would start just by saying that I was born in Montreal, Canada, province of Quebec, French-Canadian Catholic province of Canada, with a lot of control by the Vatican, the Catholic Church, on the population here. And I had an English-Canadian, Scottish-Canadian father and a French-Canadian mother. My father was Protestant and spoke only English. My mother was French Canadian, was Catholic, and spoke French and English, because anyway, that's how it was then. So I grew up with a twin brother in Montreal during the Cold War, born in 1951, and it happened to be the same year that the first conference was held in Montreal at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, that brought together the troops, the the big players who would go on to be to start the MKUltra program. And that was in August, I think, 1951. So you and Cameron was there, but Alan Dulles and all, you know, CIA, head of the CIA, and all kinds of military people in information technology at the time, medicine, psychiatry, and they just brought together all these experts. Cybernetics was, I think, starting then too, you know, so they had, and they put them in this hotel and had a conference, and they basically planned the Cold, well, the post-war period of the Cold War had already started, and how they were going to use new forms, new kinds of weapons involving human beings, like human, just the human mind would become the new battlefield, is what they, the kind of thing they were talking about at that time. And so they chose, I believe they chose Quebec because it was isolated, very fascistic, very controlled from the top down, very obedient people, very religious, and also because there was a huge population of babies born after the war to unwed mothers because the soldiers coming and going during the war. So they had everything they needed to start a project here. And I, since I was born that same year, it took another few years, but by 1955, basically my father had agreed to put my twin brother and me in the project at McGill, which was running with the famous, notorious Dr. Cameron at the head of it. And he was directly, working with Alan Dulles, in Washington, and you've heard of Sid Gottlieb, they had started in 53, they started the MKUltra program. And the other thing that had happened in Quebec in 1953 was there were 100,000 Duplessis orphans, they called them, orphans that were born to unwed mothers who had been put in orphanages after the war, because you couldn't be a single mother easily or at all in those days. And so they had a population of disposable children. So it was a great place to bring together a secret, enormous secret project. And that's, most people living here have never heard of any of this. Many people, even now, don't know that this happened. They don't know what they were, that, many people had relatives who were part of it, and they are really still living in a state of ignorance about it. So I'm a product. I was a child who was chosen for the program, more privileged than the orphans because I had a mother and a father, and I was home, living at home. And also my father was a professional. He was a music teacher in high school. So it gave us a little more status than some people. So I was put into a program at McGill with gifted children, had a high IQ, my brother also. And my brother was very musical. And so we were placed in this special program, my parents believing that this was something wonderful that had been offered to us because we were very lucky and special. And so they didn't catch on for a long time.
And so your parents, you weren't in a generational family in the sense that your parents had gone through this. They were basically coerced into thinking you were a gifted child and that they were going to pay basically for a great future for you. You'd get special education and, be around kids like you. And it wasn't like that.
Exactly. That's the difference. I think if you've had other survivors on who were definitely, they came out of generational, they even say generational satanic bloodlines. I don't think so. I mean, it's hard to find these things out, but I have none of those kinds of memories about my parents. And I have been told my parents were just basically decent people who were tricked or coerced. There was some blackmail involved because of my father's military background, and there was something going on. He was in Air Force intelligence, and I think a lot of pressure was put on him. So it was more, I think my family are different from some of the other, it's making me different from some of the other survivors, maybe too. I'm not sure how, maybe I'm more naive, and less aware of certain things. Or I don't know. Or maybe I was spared some of the stuff that they went through. I feel I witnessed some pretty horrific things, but that's all I know. I have amnesia walls too, and I'll admit that I still have them, but I'm working with it, So is that a good place to start? I don't know.
Yeah, that's, I appreciate that. I think, you know, everybody's story is so different. And I think the commonalities are what help make people understand that, oh my gosh, how is Anne's, you know, experience so similar to Kathy O'Brien's, which is so similar to this person over in the UK and then this person over in Ireland, you know, the commonalities validate it. But it happens so many different ways that it's very hard to almost, you know, comprehend. And so I love the differences and being able to talk about that too, because it helps people in real life, you know, have empathy for people and to always think, what could this person in front of me have possibly gone through? You know, because this could be anybody. It doesn't have to be a generational family. It could be a great family who's trying to do something good for their children. You know, just normal family, didn't have any of this in the background, and they make, you know, a big mistake and don't realize it, you know, maybe ever. And so I love, you know, your story brings awareness to the other side of it, which I think parents that say, well, I'm not generational. That could never happen to me or my kids. And it's like, no, this could happen to anybody.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And understanding all the different, the different circumstances that we're operating. And how that, I don't know, I guess how that also helps people, how it helps keep it secret, because people don't talk. They're not part of the, you know, the same milieu sometimes. They're living different realities. I mean, I thought of myself as having an idyllic childhood. I had a problem. When I got older, I wanted to be writing fiction, you know, and they say, well, you have to be able to remember your childhood to write your first novel. And I didn't. All I remembered were these lovely scenes, you know, in the country, swimming on the beach with my cousins, boating, you know, hot dogs, hot dog hamburger roasts and playing hide and seek. And those were my memories. They were so bland. But behind that, behind those memories, which were real, there was a whole thing going on. You know, I was being taken out of school. In first and second grade, I was being taken downtown. I was in the mental hospital. This is what I figured. My school records show that I was absent half the year. And suppose they had all these illnesses, but I had a few. I had mumps, measles, and so on, but that doesn't account for 100 days missing, exactly 100 days on my report card. And later in life, I met people who remembered me from McGill, they say, I knew McGill. I said, I never went to McGill. I didn't go to McGill. But I was a kid at a hospital that was owned and operated by McGill University and which was recruiting, you know, kids for this military program. So they remembered me sometimes, and I would just, you know, I was too little to really form memories. I think for the older kids, they had like a social existence too. And they also had, you know, stronger brains, basically more developed brains. So as a child, they would give the little kids LSD and it would just wipe them out. They wouldn't have any memory of having been through an experiment, you know, or a party with a lot of weird sadistic stuff going on, you know, and that kind of stuff. It's come back to me in different ways. So
let's dive into that a little bit. I know around age 3.5, 4 was when you were allegedly diagnosed with pneumonia. And I know that that was one of your earlier memories of this. Let's maybe talk about like how, what you experienced going into this program versus what they told your parents you'd be participating in.
Right. Well, I think that was just pneumonia. I think I actually had pneumonia, or I had a very severe cold, and it was freezing. It was January in Montreal. And what I have a very vivid memory, and I've had it all my life, of being taken on a stretcher out of the apartment building, down the walk, and into a waiting ambulance. And everything, you know, drifts, the snow drifts, and everything's frozen. And they put me in the ambulance. And they close the door. And once I'm in the ambulance, I'm looking up at the attendant, and he puts a mask over my face. And it stinks. It stinks of ether. I mean, I know the smell of ether. I was 3.5. It was not oxygen. So I pulled it off, and he was not a nice man at all. He gave me and he just forced it onto my face again. I have an absolutely clear memory of that, you know, that I've always had. And next thing I know, I woke up in a ward, I think I was strapped to the bed, and there were other children around, but then it's very vague. It's very, and I have a kind of a memory of my mother coming to see me and being very nervous and very frightened. And I have all the other memory I have is I pooed in the bed at some point. So there was this, you know, black turd lying beside me on the white sheet when I woke up, and I went, oh no. And a nurse came and she was, you know, she wasn't very happy. And she, but I've always had that memory. That's, but my mother came and wanted to know what was happening. And they told her, some of this is me being told later, they told her that I had almost died and therefore she couldn't see me. She couldn't take me home. And that's why I didn't recognize her. But what I've learned since, or what I believe, because I've seen a file, an emptied file, nevertheless, my psychiatry file from 1955, to my conscious knowledge in life, I've never seen a psychiatrist. No one ever said, we sent you to a psychiatrist when you were 4 years old. You were seeing psychiatrist. Never. I have no, it's blank, completely gone, but I had apparently a file that was quite thick. I could tell by the folder, 1955, 4 years old. And this had to be Dr. Cameron's LSD experiments at McGill, because there was no children's ward there. It was an illegal secret project. There should not have been any children at all in that hospital. There was a children's hospital for children. And I was told that you know, you cannot have a file here from 1955 because there were no children here, but then they found the file that said psychiatry. You see, so it's a convoluted process for me of finding out. My parents, I think, always just, I think they had suspicions, doubts, fears that the psychiatrists then worked at calming and coming up with explanations for. So they were always had, you know, a carrot and stick kind of situation, that there's something coming for your daughter. There's something good that's going to happen. So just, you know, just trust us, basically. And they would make up explanations and so on for things. So just if that gives an idea, I mean, that my mother had to know that I was seeing psychiatrists, but she was probably, I'm guessing now, she's been dead for 40 years. So I could never ask her. But it must have been just a case of trusting the doctors. And if they said, don't tell your daughter because that will ruin the program, you know, what we're doing for her, then she would have gone along. She wouldn't have, you know, she would have obeyed their instructions. So I grew up in I was half in, half out of school, with living a double life, as far as I can tell, and making friends downtown that I met, you know, down at McGill, who I met like when I was in my 20s. Then they came up again. They had, you know, they were, and even recognized me sometimes.
Oh my gosh, that had to have been wild for you.
It's a whole situation. I don't know where this existed. Probably did exist in other situations, in other cities, but it seems like it was an engineered program in Montreal, and a lot of it had to do with the arts, entertainment, music, and creating this a population of creators and media people who would then be part of the future, you know, program. Basically brainwashing the population through a core population that they started with when they were children. So that sort of makes sense, though, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it sounds like a testing ground almost.
Yeah. And then people were chosen further on, you know, their career. I mean, I found it very easy in the beginning, in my 20s, to just get things published and find, you know, I was being encouraged, rather than most people are discouraged from doing those kinds of things. But I was getting encouraged. I was getting encouragement. I was getting people mentoring me. I had people coming along. It all just seemed so natural, magical, normal in a way, but coincidental too. And now I see, well, you know, there was much more to the whole. There were other people, you know, also having the same things happen. They had been chosen, basically.
Talk a little bit about Dr. Cameron and McGill University and the programs that they were running. Because I think to Canada, like you said, it doesn't get, you know, recognized as much as maybe the United States or some other hotspots for this, but this was a really big deal what they were doing. And I know that they weren't the only school, but I know that, you know, Dr. Cameron, he was, you know, kind of a big deal back then in these programs. And he's a name probably a lot of people have never heard of. I'd love for you to just give some context to that. And, you know, what were they working on and what was their goal there? And, you know, what do you remember from the program?
Right. what I remember of the program is a kind of a patchwork of things that maybe I'll get to after, but Dr. Cameron was a Scottish-born American psychiatrist. He trained in Switzerland, and then he came to Canada, ran a program at a hospital, and then he went to Massachusetts too. And then he came to Montreal, but he always had contacts in Albany, New York, right? So he, that's where he, right after the war, met with Alan Dulles, the CIA OSS head at the time, who hired him to go to Nuremberg to the trials of the Nazi war criminals, right? And there was one in particular, Rudolf Hess, who was a defector. And people may know the story, they may not, but Hess had been very close to Hitler and been very high up in the SS, and then he just defected and he flew to England. So they'd had him in Spandau was Germany, I guess, but they had him in a prison in Scotland for, for the rest of the, after, I don't know, a couple of years during the war. And then in 45, they brought him back to Germany to try him for war crimes. But they wanted, because he was a defector and possibly a spy, you know, working with, who knows, could have been working for British intelligence too, or he'd be working with the Nazis. They didn't know. They probably knew, but they wanted to make sure he made the right impression at the trial. So they got two psychiatrists from New York. Well, and one of them was Dr. Ewan Cameron at the time. And the other one was Dr. Nolan D.C. Lewis. And he was head of the New York Institute of Psychiatry. And they got these two guys and they sent them over to Nuremberg in Germany and had them interview Hess. But now what people say is it's likely they brainwashed him. They wiped his memory so that when he was on trial and he was confronted with people he'd worked with in the SS, he didn't recognize them. He didn't know his former colleagues. He just didn't know them. His mind was in many ways gone. I mean, his memory was gone. They had selectively deleted memories, which they were able to do then. So he didn't incriminate himself, or, you know, he said what they wanted him to say. So that's how the trial played out. And then that was a big success, but they had those methods already, you know. They knew how to do very sophisticated brainwashing, selective memories, because some of his memories were still intact. So brought it, and so then Cameron came back to, by that point, he was the head of the Allen Memorial Institute in Montreal, which had been set up in 1943, and he started using these techniques on patients at the Allen Memorial. So the Montreal experiments that started around 1943, 1944, and that were really tied in with Nazi Germany, techniques they were using in the concentration camps on people, trauma-based mind control, right, on concentration camp prisoners and children. Mengele's clinic, you know, he used to brainwash children using trauma. So Cameron had learned, he had all those files that they'd gotten from the Nazis, and he started deploying that those techniques in Montreal on people, just old ladies and young people and all kinds of people who went in there with problems, or people who weren't getting on with their families or whatever, and their families sent them to get treated. So that's where a lot of this began. He got a lot of experience from just having access to people, to innocent, you know, Canadians. It That's Dr. Cameron. They call it the worst, the biggest, the largest, the worst, human experimentation program that has ever existed anywhere, ever been done on any population. The largest in history. You know, it's so if people haven't heard of it, it's not because it's not for lack of, you know, trying or anything. I mean, it really, but it's probably because there is always a Canada is always kind of kept in a, it's sort of in a separate place, a separate category, separate population. And I think that's also why they chose Montreal, because it was isolated and no one would, you know, no one would think things like that could go on here. And so it's been kept a secret for generations.
It's like you can see why people don't want to believe it, because it does. It sounds crazy, you know? And I think one of the things too, over generations of time, our own divinity and the supernatural abilities that we are given at birth are hidden from us. You know, we're taught a very cut and dry curriculum of you have five senses, you know, telepathy is fake and all of these things are fake. And this is just what a human is. You're a lame thing, you know, and you're going to be depressed your whole life. We're going to work you. We're going to stress you out. And so like we lose that within ourselves. And that's the thing that to me is really important to learn about these programs is there's people that know how sophisticated our software is as a human and what we are God-given born abilities that we were born with, and they're exploiting them while hiding it from the public, you know, and they're using children, especially they're so vulnerable and open to all the magic in the world, you know, and they're being exploited for it, you know? And so I think that this is, it's important. I think this conversation, it's really sad to think about what is being done and how they're exploiting. On the other hand, learning about it empowers us to say, gosh, we're amazing. Humans are incredible, what we're capable of overcoming, what our bodies are capable of doing, how pliable we are. Like just because we have trauma inside doesn't mean that we can't heal. We can heal miraculously if we learn how our brains are wired and how our bodies work, how they work together. And that's the thing I think your story paints a lot of is how, you know, the gifted and talented program and showing how these gifts are specifically sought out and exploited. And then they're not told to people that aren't in them.
That's so, so true. And you put that so well. Yeah. And that's absolutely, I think that's maybe the deepest truth we can pull out of this experience is that, or out of this history, is exactly what you've said. It's that it's exemplified by this gifted children's program. They chose kids. Some of them, they were chosen because they were psychic abilities, and which they you know tested for. I mean, the scientists knew what they were testing for, and ESP was a big thing that they were interested in because they were looking for remote viewing abilities, you know, to use for the military. But all of it, of course, like you say, it was all they chose those kids, and they had a really kind of crass military agenda behind it. But what the children had were God-given gifts that society, the churches, were in the process of repressing too. So, you know, have you been told? I mean, I'm a Christian. I'm sure you are too. But you know, I've been told by many Christians that to explore those kinds of things is satanic. And you must never. And as a result, I think I've listened to that, and I've been very careful, and I've kept, you know, but at the same time, I think there's some truth in what they say. You can be swept away by forces you don't understand. There are spiritual forces out there. They're very dark, possibly, forces. But, and that's what Satan is all about, and that's why people join cults, I guess. But they also join cults because they want to expand their, you know, just kind of expand as children of light, too. So you have this whole dichotomy that they play with all the time, and they manipulate us, and they try to terrorize us. And people separating into groups saying, oh, you know, bad over there, those people are bad. And, you know, I've had quite a bit of it, too. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, or just this is fake and this is a conspiracy. And it's like, again, not saying people have to dive into these things and explore them, but to just outright deny that these things exist. We have no idea as a society how to defend ourselves against any warfare that comes against us, or how to see it when it's right in front of us, or how to even understand, you know, a crime as big as human trafficking happening all over the world and MKUltra, you know, because they've shut all that off and just thrown it off to the side, and they've ripped it from education. And, you know, it's, I think it's really important, like I said, just understanding what they were looking for and what they know exists helps us understand how amazing we are as humans and how powerful we can be if we all come together the same way that they have.
Yeah, and take back the control. And that was, you know, I guess the results of science. I mean, that, well, observation, you know, if you live in the world long enough and you want, and you're involved in enough crazy stuff like a war, for example, you will see those abilities coming out of people, and those capacity, you know, the capacity to, that you will learn those things as a soldier, probably, very likely, haven't been a soldier. But that's why the Air Force was just, you know, the Air Force was very involved in this research, you know, going into aerospace after the war, getting children for aerospace, because setting up psychic children who, for distant early warning systems. There were children taken up north in Canada, children taken off native reservations and kept in facilities where they were trained, because they had these gifts that seemed to be genetic too, partly, and very strong in their culture, and they were used in you know, as almost like human radar, little kids, right? But then later, you know, MKUltra, you will talk to people, and people who are like the spokespeople for it will say, oh no, but it didn't work. It was just a waste of time and money. MKUltra was a complete failure, and you know, nothing is being hidden because they didn't find anything. They didn't, you know, none of these experiments were real. Like you said, they will pretend it was fake when it was very real.
Yeah, they gaslight us.
Sorry?
They gaslight us.
They gaslight us constantly. Yeah.
And we're all, I always say, we're in an abusive relationship with the government, you know?
Really? And they keep coming back and doing it over and over, and we keep voting.
I know. It's wild. But that's why I always say survivors are, you know, everybody out there is, there's people listening to survivors, of course, like people on the show. But for the most part, everybody's turning on their TV and idolizing these political influencers and these politicians and getting their news from them. And it's like, you guys, we have to listen to the people who are being silenced and the people who aren't on the news. We need to come to, like, you and other survivors, you all have the most important stories, because you have the answers to all the questions that everybody's asking, and then looking at the news to try to find the answer.
The news is nothing but lies now. It's just complete, you know, it's just a complete game of deception. I can't believe, but people do, you know, people are still being influenced by it. I guess they are. Your world gets very narrow when you're someone like me, in a way, you know, it gets narrow because there's not that much out there that you can really relate to that doesn't make you angry or, you know, just at odds with so many people. But as I say, the more the merrier, the more of us there are, the more we talk, the more podcasts like this, you know, then that's going to change. I mean, yeah, we can have a conversation at least, you know?
Absolutely. Yes. And it's beautiful. You know, it's so neat. Like, how else would I have ever met you, you know, without the internet and without other people that can kind of bridge that gap of connecting? It's really neat kind of how this whole spider web, it's, this community is becoming smaller too. And that's also what they don't want. They don't want people like me and you meeting. They don't want you meeting other survivors. They don't want podcasters bringing you on to tell your story, but it's happening.
It's happening. And I really see the audience growing. I mean, yeah, that's, they see that too. I think that scares them, but
oh, wow, we're coming, whether they want it or not.
Bring it on.
So let's go back to you. Let's talk about what were you specifically used for in these programs, and then how long did that go for in your life, and what kind of happened to transition out of that?
Well, that's interesting. I have at least a story about it, and I'll just say, it seems to involve music, which is natural because my father was a musician and a music teacher, and had been involved with the jazz scene, which was quite well developed in it was a big jazz center in the war, and so some big stars came out of Montreal, like Maynard Ferguson and Oscar Peterson. Okay, my father knew them, although he was not a great musician or anything, but he played in a band, and so I think it's just natural that I would have been streamed. My brother was musical too, into some sort of program where I was at least around music, because that's been my life. I don't really play well. I sing a bit, but you know, I've never really developed musically. I haven't become a musician in any way, but I've always been around musicians. So I think as a child, I was put in a program where there were some future rock stars. This is what I think. That's kind of catchy to people, probably. But I think it is what happened. And they were training. Dr. Cameron believed that rock music, by about 1960, he was saying this, I think, rock and roll was a way to spread mental illness to a society. Rock music was, I mean, you know, the people of his generation would have looked at, you know, Eddie Cochran, or just, you know, Chuck Berry, these Fats Domino, and said, well, these people are abnormal. You know, look how they, Elvis Presley, mainly, you know, look how that person's behaving. This is completely like animalistic, and these people are sick. But their goal in many ways was to kind of break down society and make people create kind of a chaotic world that they could then take control of, order out of chaos. So they saw rock and roll as a way to channel mental illness. And you would choose people who were mentally ill, and they would play their music, and then the audiences would go crazy. And they did go crazy. I mean, look at the girls screaming at the Beatles and Elvis and so on, all those, you know, that trend in the 50s and so on. They watched it and they thought, how can we, you know, we're going to use this. Plus they had developed forms of electronic, you know, signals through music. The music industry was taken over by the military in the mid 50s, pretty much, especially maybe in England, and you know, EMI studios, which had the Beatles and the Stones and all the big, you know, they were recording all the big bands and all the big groups. That EMI was the label. It stands for Electronic Music Incorporated, and it was an Air Force. It was an extension of the Air Force and of Tavistock, right? The Tavistock Institute was also involved in that. So they really had an idea that they were using sound to program children's brains, and they did that on military bases. They probably did it to me. I know they were doing it, you know, around Montreal to children. And it's basically to see what you could do with sound to someone, to change someone's brainwaves. And so that absolutely was part of what rock and roll was intended to be. It was just a form of, you know, mass entrainment. And so at McGill in 1956, I'm fairly sure that I was, that there were kids brought over from England who later went on to become rock stars. And they were at the party that I attended when I was 5 years old. And my father, being a music teacher and being still having kind of fairly senior, you know, in his, and we were well established and up to a point. And my mother having sort of French Canadian political, my mother was from the French Canadian elite, and in her youth, she really looked like a movie star. So I think there was I think that's what I was chosen for. There was the idea that I would go on, I would become part of the scene that they were in the process of creating over mostly in England, right? In London, Tavistock Institute, you know about that, right? You know about that institute. So they were involved in all kinds of cultural stuff and music and so on. And I would find my way into that, possibly as a model, or maybe as a groupie or something, or I don't know what, you know, maybe I was being groomed in some way. But I think when I was about 12, I blew it. And I think my father also got into the act and realized that what was going on was basically kind of child trafficking, sexual programming of me, right? And that a grooming for something that his own morality, right, his own ethics were against, and rock and roll. He certainly, you know, he didn't want his daughter to marry a Rolling Stone. That was the big thing at the time, you know. And would you let your daughter marry a Rolling Stone? Because those groups, those bands were just totally overthrowing traditional morality. So parents were appalled by, you know, the music and so on. So that, I think, was the cutoff point for me. And after that, I think it put me into kind of a different stream where they were grooming me to have some kind of career at the United Nations, probably, you know, administrative, something boring, you know. And so I was put in a I was moved to a different school. I had a whole set of different friends. It wasn't about music anymore. It was just very like, I became a prefect at school and I was like editor of the newspaper and that kind of stuff. But I was like being groomed for some sort of intellectual, you know, and so that's in a nutshell, that's what happened to me. Was that, you know, but originally it was going to be music. And I think they flew me to London in 1963, just as the Rolling Stones were, you know, and were launching their first record. And I think I was there for that. I have a recovered memory of it, you know. So it's kind of, I find that kind of exciting to remember that now, to have flashbacks and to, you know, and even having conversations about it with people who were there. It's recent for me to even be able to remember some of this stuff. And, it's not all bad in my opinion, because I don't think rock and roll really was bad. I think rock and roll actually was a liberating force. And I think it worked against the program. As much as it did program people, it also made people awake and critical. And so I don't know. I think it's this story of several generations. I don't know how it is for your generation now with music and what is happening, coming to you through music, or what music you listen to. But, you know, I think that's what happened to me back in the 60s, right?
Well, that's interesting too, because, you know, frequency, that's another thing that people kind of keep out of the way. And it's such a big thing that they use against us. You know, music has been changed dramatically, all genres, from the frequency that it's broadcasted to the words that they say to the harmonics. You know, music used to be these, you know, beautiful like Beethoven compositions and just layers of music, you know, and now it's, you know, auto-tuned, and it's, you know, it is in a lot of ways satanic, like what is, you know, being broadcast in mainstream, you know.
Absolutely,
but
it seems to be, yeah.
But it's fascinating that you say that, because, you know, that's been something I think, especially the last couple of years, that people have become more aware of, is the Hollywood model, and looking at it with a critical eye finally and saying, what is happening on the screen right now? Like, this is weird. You know, why are people dressed as devils? And, you know, why are celebrities walking out in blood and, you know, talking about these things? Like, it's become very obvious now to people, and it's finally getting attention. But I think the whole music industry, like you said, you know, they've inverted music so much to where they use those frequencies against us, and it puts us as humans in a low frequency. You know, when you think about rock music, I think some rock music can almost be popish, you know, but then you have like the heavy metal that branched off from rock music, which is, you know, extremely toxic. And like you said, getting a reaction, you go to a concert and people are mosh pitting. There's people that have died at those concerts. You know, it's like, they just constantly are trying to push the boundaries on like what raises frequency and then what lowers it. And how do we control people using those different dynamics? You know,
you're right. It's so multifaceted too. You know, there's so many sides to it. I mean, I read somewhere, I mean, heard that in 1972, that's when the rock music industry completely switched over to Satanism. There's some people say that. I mean, they say that's when the new bands coming in had to sign contracts, or they also when they began taking screams, recorded screams of children being tortured in underground bases and so on, and they began, you know, adding it, how do you call that, you know, subliminals, putting it into the music as subliminals. All of that took off in 1972 was the cutoff date. So, you know, I don't know. I lost interest in music after 1972, but that was just because I was in my, I was just at an age where you're not that interested after, in your 20s. It's not like when you're 14, you know, you're riveted to music. You're being really, you know, you're really vulnerable to all of it. But by the time it was 1972, I was 21. I was kind of in the, you know, not interested. I was, but anyway, I think it's just gotten much worse, much more sophisticated. And yet there's great music. I mean, if you kind of listen out there, there's all kinds of wonderful music that's playing even on, you know, I used to keep my radio on a few years ago. And I mean, I would hear great things, but some of it was from other countries, other cultures that didn't have French. The French didn't have this, you know, and in Montreal, I could tune into French stations, hear French pop music and not get this, that, I don't know, I could listen to it, you know. It didn't seem to be there to destroy your mind. It seemed to be there to, you know, do the things that music's supposed to do. Make you fall in love, you know.
That's incredible too, just how, you know, different parts of the world might have a different type of program that's being run. And it's almost like the whole world's their experiment, you know? And it's like, this country, we're going to try this. This country, we're going to try that. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And then they're just observing with a microscope saying, what's going on? Like we're in these little petri dishes in our countries.
Yeah. And they're all running it through the giant computer, you know, the beast or whatever. And, you know, and they can spend the rest of the next 100 years if they need to analyzing it. And
exactly. You know. Yes. 100%. And so after, let's say, age 11, 12, when your father had some maybe discernment and said, okay, we need to move on from this, was there ever discussions? I'm sure you didn't remember anything, but what happened after that until your memory started recovering?
I just got, one thing about my father is they took him and they put him in the hospital and they brainwashed and they also depatterned him. That was what Dr. Cameron, you know, called his method depatterning, which was to take, you know, basically to interfere with the neurology of the, you know, of the brain, you know, and to he said we were all, I don't know, I was just reading the other day, they were people's minds, people's psychology is really just a whole complex system of multi-layered patterns, but if you shake up those patterns, you can change the person. You get a different person. So he would literally wipe people's minds. I mean, with electroshock and drugs and so on, and repeated messages, and it played hundreds of times through with a football helmet and earphones and a battery or something running this tape in people's heads, and so my father actually was taken from his work, from the school where he was teaching in December 1962, and put in the hospital. And he stayed there for 6 weeks. And when he came home, he really had that. He didn't really recognize us at first. He had to relearn, you know, his own identity. And that's what happened to my father in 1962. Now, I was 11 at that point. They hadn't finished with me, as far as I can tell, because I was an asset to them and they had paid money for me. So the fact that my father was now kind of, he couldn't work anymore. He was at home and he was, that you know, he was sort of pushed aside. They continued working on me at that point. And that's, I think, the following year is when I think they sent me to London on a, you know, and I remember being in London in 1963, you know, walking down the street in this little dress. But that's just come to me in the last 3 years, 2 years, that memory. I didn't have that memory for most of my life. So, okay, what I think then, I think that caused a crisis in my family, and we suddenly we began making plans to move out west, to completely leave our home, everything behind. And my parents loaded up the car, and we were going to Alberta, and we drove across Canada that summer. But something must have happened when we got out there. Maybe we saw kind of Canada, and we really want to leave Montreal and live out on the prairies, you know. And I don't know, but anyway. They changed their minds and we drove back and then kind of resumed our lives. So then a year later, I was in high school. In high school, that's another, that was for the first year of high school, it was music, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, and the whole, and all of my friends were crazy about the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and a television program called The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which when you look at it now, you can see the people writing that program had to know a lot about MKUltra. So that was, okay, we were watching it weekly, and it was a kind of programming coming at us through a spy, you know, it was about two spies, one was Russian, one was American, and they worked together for this United Nations type of organization, and they went all over the world doing crazy things and so on. We loved this show, but I think also it was triggering some kind of programming or something too, at least maybe in me, or I don't know, maybe other kids who, you know, at school. So it was after that year. So after 1965, I seem to have decided that I had to be moved to another school and put into another, onto another track in life. And that just took me to university. I mean, once I was in university, all I wanted to do was make revolution, you know, was overthrow society. I was angry. I joined the women's movement. I joined, you know, Black Power was happening. And I just got involved in as much of that kind of thing as I could be involved in 1968, 1969. And so that, you know, and then I lived in a women's commune and, you know, and, went to abortion demonstrations and, you know, we did all kinds of...
That was the whole hippie revolution, right?
Activist, yeah, period. And a lot of American draft dodgers had come up to Montreal, so they were really organizing a lot of these things too. So that was my kind of career. I mean, until my mid-20s when I got fed up with the women's movement, I could see that it was like a form of mind control. I didn't like what was happening to the women that I knew who were in it, who at first we started out with so much optimism and hope and energy and positivity, and it became something very different, very negative, very anti-male, very, very narrow in some way. And I just said, I have to get out of this. And at some point, not that long after, I met Leonard Cohen. And he was a figure in Montreal who had, at that point, a kind of ambiguous figure, but at the same time, famous in his own way. And he became a kind of a mentor for me. So that took me off in a really different direction. He had been in the hospital himself. He had gone through the program. Dr. Cameron, he had been there, been electroshocked numerous times. Many people had seen him in there, he even talked about it to some extent. And so I think he was a programmed singer, writer, poet, and all these things, but at a higher level where he had become himself a programmer. And I think he was my handler. But, you know, at the time, again, it was like a wonderful, you know, wonderful coincidence to run into him or have him phone me one night, you know, invite me over. And so that's when my life took off in a different kind of a different direction. I started writing and I began kind of imagining this career as a writer, journalist, you know. I was writing poetry, all kinds of stuff. So
about how did you meet him and how did that come about?
He used to just, everyone could meet him, and you know, in some way, he was often just wandering around town. He had a bad reputation, you know, with women, picking up young women, and so he was someone to avoid in many ways. At least that I did for years, avoid him. You know, he would stop you. You'd pass him in the street. He'd be there, you know, and you would recognize him, you know, and then he'd try to start a conversation. He was in bars a lot, you know, and at the same time he was going, you know, he was going to Israel, and he was, you know, fighting in the Yom Kippur War and coming back, and he bought some buildings and had a little corner of the downtown that was kind of several buildings that he owned. And then he started a family, had a couple of kids, you know, and when I met him, his children were, I think, 3 years old and five, 3 and 5. And he had split with his wife. So he just phoned, he got my number from someone that I knew who was his carpenter, who was renovating one of his buildings. And this person had been telling me about Leonard, and, you know, you should meet Leonard. And I was saying, I don't know. And finally I gave him my phone number. And I said, if you see Leonard, you know, maybe he can, you know, here's my phone number. So within 24 hours, I got a phone call. And he invited me over. It was that simple. I lived about 2 blocks from him at that point, 2 or 3 blocks. I was there in, you know, 10 minutes or something. And then just friendly, you know, social kind of chatting and tea, and played this guitar and sang cowboy song. And that's how I kind of, you know, got sucked in. So it was, you know, and I felt very lucky that this had happened. I didn't understand. Like, I'm sure now that what he was doing was, he was kind of calling me back. He was assigned to me. He was partly acting out of, you know, instructions, because I had started publishing poetry. So he, and a book had come out, and I was in this anthology, and he told me he'd read my poems, and that's why he called me, because he liked them better than anyone else's, you know, that's what he said. Then that's what I believed, you know, at the time. Oh, he likes me, you know. But I think there was much more to it. Yeah, much more was going on, and it was about getting me back into the under the umbrella.
And you had mentioned that in other interviews that you've done about a possible connection whenever you were a child with him at the McGill University. Could you talk about that?
Right. You've heard that story now. I can't find another way to explain how closely he seemed to be able to relate to me when I was meeting him for the first time, how he seemed to know me, how he seemed to, you know, he invited me into his world. It really made no sense, and nobody would believe it. You know, like, why would he do that? Because it wasn't like I was running after him and trying to seduce him, or that I was a very sexy woman who, you know, he found irresistible or something like that. It was absolutely not. And it was just like a friendly thing, but it was somehow family. And about how many years ago, 5, 6 years ago, I had a friend who's since deceased, but he did a meditation one day and told me he was going to go into what the causes of this relationship with Leonard Cohen that had eaten up a lot of my life, had really taken up a lot of space in my life. He didn't think that, he said, there's something wrong. Oh, there's something, there's got to be a reason for it. He did a meditation, and he saw me as a child on a table in the hospital, kind of on a, you know, a stretcher or something, surrounded by doctors in white jackets. And they were electroshocking me. And I was I was 4 or 5 years old is when I think this actually happened. Now, I had had my own flashback to that a couple of years before, but I never talked about it. And I never told him. But he kind of spontaneously, you know, traveled to that time, saw that happening. And he saw that, you know, and I, from my own flashback, I knew they electroshocked me to the heart. And it caused my heart to, you know, splutter, not, you know. And then they said, well, if we do this again, it could be lethal. And okay, we'll try. I mean, that was their attitude. I mean, that was these doctors, right? Oh, let's do it. So they were about to do it. And in my flashback, that's the point where I woke up kind of in a feeling shocked, kind of, right, you know, jumping in the air almost off the table. And I woke up from the flashback, and, you know, that's what happens often. You can't go beyond a certain point. You just can never find out. So my friend Patrick saw what happened at that point. He said, a guy comes running in the room. It's Leonard Cohen. He's like 20 years old, and he stops it from happening. For me, it was completely believable because it explained the whole psychology of my relationship with Leonard, where he was called me Wee Annie, even though I was 6 feet tall, and, you know, and you know, he had little habits, you know, he was sort of sometimes as if he saw me as a little girl, which I was not. I was 26 years old and I was 6 feet tall and I was not a little girl, you know, he was 5'7". So, I mean, it just explained, it explained his patience with me. It explained how he was very tolerant of a lot of things. He was very jovial. He kind of treated me in this way that, you know, it just wiped away all the strange unanswered questions of the relationship, which had gone on for 20 years and which really fell apart because of another little girl where, you know, where I began to sense this pedophile, you know, undercurrent too. And it just freaked me out completely. So that's really one reason why the relationship, my relationship with him couldn't continue. But, you know, I think he just, I don't know if I've ever said that before to anyone, but I mean, I think he was part of a generation and his own like programming was the Hugh Hefner generation. And they were introducing pedophilia along with all the, you know, things in the 60s, the sexual revolution and the feminism and all the things that were suddenly, you know, current and they were being promoted everywhere, like trans culture. Now they were really beginning to promote sex between children and adults in the 70s. Hefner was hinting at it in Playboy, and, you know, it was going to be the next thing. And I think Cohen felt also that it was, I don't know if he believed in it so much as he felt it was inevitable or something. And so I picked up on that sometime around, you know, in the late 70s, I began noticing that, and I just, you know, found it anyway.
Wow. Did he say certain things, or what was it that gave you that vibe? What was it that gave you that vibe? Did he make comments, or what did he do?
Behavior, talk. It was, yeah, I don't want to talk too much about people, but yeah, things he said, some behavior with children. Not that I saw sexual behavior. I didn't, but I sensed the atmosphere and what the children were being exposed to and what they knew about, which seemed like, you know, I mean, of course, later generations were exposed to a lot more than my little generation, you know, in the 50s. But nevertheless, I found some of it, you know, disturbing. And I couldn't get a clear answer out of him, I guess, about it. And I just started to distance myself, you know. I don't know what more to say about it. It's just more like he felt, I think he, you know, in the same way that he embraced religion in a very, you know, like, a total kind of way, he would take on these kinds of beliefs and so on. He was dogmatic in a strange way. It's like he saw his role as being to, you know, to uplift people in some ways and teach them, you know, the Torah, teach them the true teachings of Judaism or Christianity too. But then he'd also, you know, sort of teach him about the programming that was coming. You know, he was kind of an all-around mouthpiece. I mean, he never stopped talking, you know, like me now. I understand it better now. But
I thought it was interesting, too, how you had mentioned, and it's not surprising, but it's just, again, there's so many hidden societies and hidden roles that people have behind the scenes that the public doesn't see? How you had mentioned he was a 33rd degree Freemason.
Yeah, I've been told that by several people. Yeah.
And then he had also talked about and kind of hinted at bringing you into kind of a weird cult that he may have been in, right? Wasn't he talking to you about some cult, like a death cult or something like that?
It was, there was a period when he seemed to be forming a cult, and he was also a member. He was a student of a Zen master in California called Sasaki Roshi. So he'd been studying for, a couple of decades, I guess. And he started talking about bringing Judaism and the Kabbalah together with Zen and creating a new religion and symbolism and so on. And this was at a low point in his music career. I think that's when people get into these kinds of things, So you could see it was very much on his mind and to talk about religion, but a kind of cult, kind of culty type of religion, the kind of thing, it's Masonic, essentially Masonic. And he had, he designed these symbols, male and female energies, and then I think his career, I think that kind of ended when suddenly he had a hit record again in about 1988. He found a new manager and she rebuilt his career. And suddenly, I think that's when he kind of, in a way, dropped put aside the religious thing, and got into music for a few years, and he just had this checkered career. I also believe I know for a fact he went on missions. He was a mercenary, but no one knows that. It seems nobody really wants to look at that, but I would say he was often in places where where Mossad, had installed itself, or the CIA was involved, or there was a revolution in progress, and he seemed to play some kind of role in revolutions and coups and things like that. The Bay of Pigs in 1961 in Cuba, and in Ethiopia, Israel, well, during the war there. Yeah. So he was a military person. He had weapons training, It was very complicated.
Yeah. And I think especially for you, having this coincidental, what you thought was coincidental relationship with him, and then finding out later potentially that maybe this relationship, in a sense, or just this connection was going on for a very long time since you were little.
Yeah. And there was affection that came. I believe there was a strong, this was the whole thing about it. It was hard to dismiss from me, that there seemed to be genuine affection. And it was quite, complicated to process. For a while I thought he's just a Buddhist, he just loves everyone. And so I would introduce people to him thinking, well, he's going to love them too. You'll get some of this love. And they didn't, And then so slowly, it took me a long time to realize, well, it's because, he doesn't love everybody. But he remembers this little girl that he knew at one point in the hospital. Wee Annie, That was the whole thing. It's very simple when you figure it out. But I had amnesia, right? I had no memory. All of that was gone from the LSD and or whatever they did to me to make me forget all of that. He remembered, though, So.
And this, it humanizes him. I think that's the other thing that people who didn't go through something like you, on the outside, when you hear about, the abuse that people are indoctrinated into in these systems and the things that they're forced to do, it's not good. It's very, there's a lot of violence, a lot of trauma. There's a lot of forcing people to do things against their will. There's a lot of non-consensual actions, and then those people grow up to then perpetuate it onto the next generation. Right. And so, of course, society should be so angry that these people are out there walking, there's very little persecution. But at the same time, it helps to humanize people and to remember that they were also born children of God who were abused, and these people were taken advantage of. They were programmed. They never had a choice their whole life. And a lot of them still, I bet any of them, you know, if they would have had a choice, they would have chosen love, and they would have chosen to be kind to the child or the children, you know, and it just didn't happen that way because they never had that choice and they never got that choice. And I love how your story, you know, it paints the picture of who he might have been, you know, this intel person who was handling you. All his intentions or the things that he was made to do with the relationship may not have been pure, but it seems like there was a place in his heart that was very pure for you and that he showed that to you for a long time.
Yeah. And that's, again, you're so clear. Yeah, exactly. And it's taken me many years to kind of process that and come to that kind of understanding of it. You know, he died in 2016 and, I don't know. I had a lot of resentment against him up until that point, you know, right up until his death, I think. And once he was gone, it was as if we still had a relationship in some way, but it had changed. And the pressure that he used to constantly complain about, the obligations and the feeling of he had no choice in the matter in many things. He used to say that all the time, and I used to just not understand it. You know, I used to go, what do you mean? You know, you're a millionaire. I mean, you're famous. You're telling me you have no control over your career. But I think it was absolutely true because the career would never have come to him had he not made all these deals and all these, you know, all these secret agreements that then he had to pay the price for. And so once he was dead, thank you, Lord. You know, once he was dead, all of that just dissolved. And in a way, I felt also free from a lot of things because I didn't have to think about him anymore and think about all the, you know, all these puzzling, you know, I had still had these memories of things that had happened. It's just, you can be free. If you can overcome your fear of death, you're free of most things in this world. That's really what it's all based on. That's how they get us, you know?
Yes. So, especially like we've definitely seen that, you know, amplified the last few years. Everything's been death and dying and you're going to get people sick. And, you know, it's been this huge warfare mm-hmm. against us being afraid of us dying of something or us giving somebody something that's going to kill them, you know, and that it's so powerful what that does to a whole society when you, you know, implant that fear and trauma onto them on a grand scale.
It's like blackmailing a whole society, isn't it? You know, just stealing everything. Yeah. Stealing their choices.
Yeah.
And going, every generation has to learn the lesson in their own way over and over again. And it's always really the same lesson, I guess, you know, like, who am I and what am I capable of and what will I accept? What won't I accept? And, you know, what am I here to do? Comes down to those things.
Yes.
And wearing a mask and going around, you know, staying indoors for a year, you know, that's not why I came here, you know.
Right. Yes. And taking back the gifts that are ours that they want to exploit and, you know, lower the frequency of, you know, and step into who we are.
Yeah. We're working on it.
We're working on it. And yeah. So let's go into when you started to have memory recall. When did that happen and what triggered that for you to say, oh my gosh, my life wasn't what I thought it was?
Big time I was 50. I had just turned 50. So it was in 2003. I mean, time flies. But really all my life I had some very strange memories. Like I remembered and told my mother when I was 4 or 5 about being in an underground base where children were being tortured basically. And at 4, I had a very vivid, you know, I don't know. I mean, dream fantasy, but it was a scenario that came up for me every night. I would recreate it in my mind, but because I'd experienced it, I felt, but my mother said, well, it's a dream. It's a nightmare, you know, and it's not real. But it was identical. It was odd. There were odd details about it that were identical to another survivor that I found out about. I started in 2003, and it might have been Svali. I'm not sure, but I think maybe it was. But it was China Lake Military Base in California had the exact scenario that I remembered. And I have proof it because I wrote about it in the 1980s. I wrote a short story that got published that describes it. So I can't, nobody can say, well, you just read about it on the internet in 2000. And then you know, it absolutely was with me all my life. So that's, you know, memories. I remember some of the trauma, in my family. I remember, some of the things that, that were odd that were happening, like not being at school, half the year. And, but a lot of that's just behind amnesia walls, or they create, anyway, just odd things. And then, in 2003, that's when I really had the time, and I instantly plowed into MKUltra. I basically stumbled on it and recognized certain things and realized this was what is my city, my time. My father had been, in the Allen with this same doctor, and it could, we were involved in it. I mean, but no one had ever told me that before. It had been downplayed, and my parents were more concerned about not knowing. They didn't want us to know because they didn't understand it either. They wouldn't have been able to explain it. And it had traumatized them, and they just didn't want our lives to be, ruined by it. So they tried to pretend that nothing had happened. And that's why I have all these idyllic memories of childhood and, and of having been successful at school. I wasn't I was like a model student. And that was my conscious, with the word, my front altar, I guess, was like that. But once I started researching, then, things began fitting together. It's funny because some people get flooded. I was warned. Some people go and get hypnotized and or see therapist and try to recall the memories. I was warned not to do that, so I didn't do it. Just at the beginning of, in the early 2000s. Instead, I approached it from the outside and I did research. I read thousands of pages about MKUltra. I corresponded with people. I still didn't believe that I had been in it as a child until I met a group of psychics in Montreal. And they basically came to me and said, "We want to work with you. We think you have a story." One of them in particular, who I had met, who could see, who said my father told him, my father had been dead for 30 years at that point, but your father is telling me that his story needs to be told and you need to tell it. And I have a group of people that will work with you. And I was still pretty, I knew a lot about the program. I knew not about the history. I had studied it now for a year. So I knew the history of it all, but I didn't see where I fit into it. And these people were just natural remote viewers. And they formed like a circle, and we met week after week. And sometimes we videoed, or taped the session. And they went to, without my giving them any kind of instructions, because I wasn't sure what to tell them, they went back to McGill in 1960 and talked to the children who were living in the laboratory under the ground and going through experiments. And I didn't know about those children then. And none of them knew about the children. And we had got their names and their life stories. And we even looked at their files. And it was a whole, that took up a year or two or even longer. That was just amazing. And it was, we were all just blank. We're not in no way, except for me, who had done all the reading and the research, but couldn't connect it to my own life or my own, really yet. I wasn't able to put it together. And these people filled in all those blanks. So that is okay. That's where I'll show you. This is my book, and I wrote this in 2004, and it's called My Cold War, and the story of the remote viewing is in there. It's really kind of a self-published book with, it has its flaws, but that's what came out of that, that whole period and so on, and all the research. Just telling my family.
Your book is your testimony, right? And people can purchase that?
Yeah. First person, did you say?
I said, where can people purchase that?
Ah, online, you can go to my website. It's like, you can go to, if you Google Ann Diamond, My Cold War, A-N-N, Diamond, My Cold War, and you might put in Amazon or Lulu, either it should be available on both. And you should be able to get copies either. And there's free. I have it on my website. I'm giving away the PDF free. If somebody wants to, you know, contact me, I can send them the PDF or they can download it.
Oh, that's amazing. So you said Amazon, Lulu, or they could contact you directly and get a PDF of it.
Yeah. Or even just if they could find, I don't know. Yeah. I can give you a link at the end of the show.
So talk about that process a little bit. Like why and how did you decide to go public? And what was that like for you, especially because like how we were talking about earlier, it was a different time back in the early 2000s. You know, what was your motivation to do that? And like, what was the process?
I was motivated by the idea I had a great story and then it would get published and millions of people would read it. Maybe thousands, you know, in Canada, and then it would make a big difference and it would help people because, you know, that was my motivation and my belief. But what actually happened was there was I was completely shut down in every direction that I went to talk to publishers, agents, editors, you know, magazines, anybody that I approached, instantly shut me down. And I'd published in a couple of novels at that point, and I had, you know, I had been teaching creative writing in a university and so on, and I knew all kinds of people. You know, I'd been a journalist, I had a column, you know, in the Montreal Gazette, and writing, and so I sort of had this public, you know, personality in a way, persona. But once I came out with this story, I had the manuscript. And I started trying to just tell people, publishers, you know, maybe you'd be interested in this. It's a fantastic story. It's very disturbing, you know, I believe they rejected it without reading it because they already knew I was not the first. And they already knew that it was absolutely taboo. The topic is taboo. You cannot talk about it in Canada. It's because of the children, because I was talking about the children. And they have just crushed that, you know, even though at conferences in the States at the time, it was being talked about and there were people in Canada that were researching it and I have met them and so on, but nobody has had a book published as far as I know. So what happened was just a complete blacklisting and everybody just, you know, and then I think people were told I was schizophrenic and I, you know, don't even deal with her and she's gone crazy. And it was a real, that happened pretty fast. And then I just pulled myself out. I moved to Greece. I mean, I found a boyfriend in Greece and a life in Greece that was just kind of given, just offered to me at that same time. And I just said this, you know, I can't be here and just fight with this because there's no, I can't even get a fingernail hold, you know, anywhere. Nobody will talk to me. And they're ready to forget everything, like that they even knew me and just, you know, fall into line. It was shocking, really, to see people, you know. It's been 20 years almost, yeah. And finally, you know, a group has formed. There's a lot of... there are two lawsuits. In fact, you could say there are three lawsuits in progress, class action suits. There's been some media attention. They still don't talk about children unless it's Aboriginal, it's Native children, Indigenous children, the Mohawk children, because they can't deny that anymore. They found all the mass graves they found the mass graves all across the country. So they can't stop the Mohawk mothers from saying our children are buried at McGill. And this has made a huge difference because there are other children buried at McGill. There's a lot of, I think, Mohawk kids, yes, in the ground. There are a lot, I don't know how many, but a lot of missing Mohawk children. But I believe there are other children there. And all across Canada, there are mass graves with children. But you can imagine, I mean, the Department of Defense has completely, you know, they control the media, I guess, if, you know, if there's anyone, I think there was a documentary that was going to air in about 1998 and they just canceled it it's never been seen. Yeah, as I was told. Yeah.
It's amazing to me how long they've been able to cover all this up, you know, because there's even proof the CIA has come out and said, we did this. It stopped, but we did it, you know, and people still are like, oh, that never happened, or it couldn't happen. And you had said in an interview, you're like, why would they stop something that was so effective? You know, why would we just believe, oh, it worked great, we're just going to stop it though, because the public doesn't want us to do it anymore, you know?
It's just so tricky, and they find different ways, and they destroyed or they hid the records. You know, I'm sure they had many panic attacks when they realized that what they were sitting on. And I'm sure that still goes on today at McGill University, which, you know, there was an injunction, and they had agreed to produce the records, and they've reneged on their agreement. Within 2 weeks, they were saying, no, we won't. We said we would, but no, we won't. Well, because they can't, I think because they can't without completely, you know, exposing everything. And who wants to know? Does anyone want to know? Well, we do, you know.
Yeah.
We need to know. But
I think more people, too, would want to know if they could just wrap their mind around that it's possible. You know, people are just, they've just been told so many times, repetition, mind control, right? This is fake. This is a conspiracy. So people don't even want to consider it, you know, and even trauma in itself, we're so not dialed in as a society on how trauma actually affects our bodies. And like you were saying with the Tavistock Institute, the whole Rockefeller, you know, education system, they've dumbed down and taken out of textbooks for psychologists and counselors, people that could have an impact, don't even have access to this information. And so they think it's a conspiracy when somebody like you comes in and says, here's everything I went through, here's what's going on in my body. And they say, you're crazy, we're going to lock you up, you know? And it's so sad because it's actually really powerful and interesting how trauma affects us and then learning how we can undo that. And so many people would benefit if they had that knowledge. And instead, people don't even realize that what they're dealing with is trauma, much less how to help themselves through it.
Yeah, and trauma, and just even hearing about it is traumatic, you know.
Yes.
Just knowing this whole story is a form of trauma in itself, apart from, you know, the tortures and so on. And they tortured people, sensory isolation. I mean, what they did with children at McGill went in directly into the CIA's torture manual. You know, Kubark torture manual has methods that were developed at McGill by Dr. Hebb and Dr. Cameron, and they were great names, Dr. Lehman, you know, great names in medicine or science, you know, that could really turn you against science. I mean, what they did was just such a distortion of psychiatry. You know, when I was, I don't know, in my teens or something, I thought I wanted to be a psychiatrist when I grew up. I wanted, you know, I was reading books on psychiatry and R.D. Lang and, you know, all the transcendental, you know, consciousness. And I thought that's what psychiatrists are. It's to help people open up to this, you know, this bigger universe and to heal themselves and all that. But what was being done at McGill at that time was actual torture. You know, it was intended. It was military mind control with there was no healing at all. They just destroyed. They destroyed families. They destroyed patients. They went after their children. It was just a criminal. It was a criminal operation, right in the middle of a world famous, you know, institution that was being looked to as a model, you know, around the world. It just makes no sense, or it does, you know, make sense, but.
It does once you learn. But I mean, you've even said, you know, this was happening at Harvard and this was happening at these other, you know, Ivy League A-list schools.
It was. So I don't know. Just recently I read an article from the New Yorker about a guy who claims it was very convincing, very persuasive, you know, personal story of a guy who was so depressed he was ready to kill himself and electroshock cured him. And how he describes, it's from a couple of years ago in the New Yorker. I just read it the other day, and all I could think of was, this is so different. His experience, the doctors were trying to help, but they were very firm. We are going to give you this treatment. It's the only thing that you can help you. And the nurse, you know, and he knew all these people who were suffering, and he just describes it. It's so humane. It's New York Institute of Psychiatry that he was in, you know, Columbia University. And it's the same institution that was doing the military mind control, you know, experiments in the 50s and destroying people, imprisoning people. And so what is it? Is it just certain people that they select that they actually help? Or is it different, you know, different time periods, different? What is going on? I mean, you know.
It's wild. What helped you when you were healing? You mentioned the group of people that came around you and helped you, maybe remote view. What other tools were really helpful for you? I know it's not the same for everybody, but I love talking about that a little bit because something, you know, that you say might be really helpful for somebody.
I went to the, what was called the SMART conference, I don't know, in Connecticut, and there was a group of people, including Carol Rutz, and I don't know if you know Wanda Carriker. She wrote a book. You know her book? Now I can't remember the name, but
The name sounds familiar, but I wouldn't be able to recall what her book is called.
She wrote a book with something entitled like, I forget. Anyway, something about the dawn or I forget, but it's a really very good novel about a small town in New England where people are going through these kinds of cult programming experiences. Anyway, she was there and a lot of other people. And there was a kind of a discussion. What is the best form of therapy that you can recommend? Afterwards, you know, people were talking about it online and they did a poll of, I don't know, a lot of survivors. And number one is talk therapy. If you can afford that or find somebody who'll talk to you, you know, I never could. And the second is writing. So I'm fine with that. They're very close. I can't remember the other, play therapy, sandbox. I don't know, you know, but those two are absolutely at the top. So I think if someone, you know, I never could afford to see a therapist. I never went for therapy. I wonder what would have happened if I had, you know, back before all this. They probably would have given me drugs or something. I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
I'm glad I've always had this habit of writing. And I think it's a good habit to cultivate. And it's very helpful to go back and look at yourself as you, you know, what you wrote 10, 20 years ago, if you can keep that, you know, or even 2 years ago, or even 6 months ago. I used to, you know, often kind of keep diaries. And now it's mostly in emails, but I still can find those, you know,
And writing is so powerful too, just because it doesn't elicit that same fight or flight, sympathetic nervous system response. It's kind of the opposite. So it's a lot easier to process without having to speak it. You know, remember when you were saying that when you started talking, you would shake. And it's very different when you can keep quiet and just hold a pen and write. Like, it affects our body differently and puts us in a different, you know, a different state.
You're right. Do you write yourself? Do you?
I love writing, yes. I love writing, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of comes through, you know, that anyway, you're your own therapist then, but you're also your friend, your best friend in a way. You can talk to yourself without having to, you know, make excuses. And I think it leads to eventually, you know, an integrated personality. It can take a long time for some people.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, luckily now we have people like you, we have people like Kathy O'Brien and, you know, Lisa Meisters and a lot of people who have healed and who all have different ways of doing it. And now hopefully people who are going through what you did, you know, to some degree, or who are dealing with different levels of trauma, they'll be able to find people like you and get tools more easily than they would have been able to 20, 30, 40 years ago, you know, even 5 years ago. You know, so my hope is that people, you know, the process of healing accelerates with time as more people speak out, more people share, more counselors talk to people like you, you know, instead of just trusting their textbooks, they say, what did you go through? You know, and how does it affect your body, and start learning outside of the box, you know? So that gives me a lot of hope too, that there's more information on actual trauma and actual healing of, you know, DID and just extreme trauma that's being advocated for by survivors.
And you're seeing that happening, right?
Yes.
That's in the future. That's happening. You see it.
I'm seeing it. Yeah. I'm seeing therapists now talk to satanic ritual abuse survivors and MKUltra survivors and work with those people and try to understand, you know, that clientele versus just the type of that they learned about in school. And I think that's amazing. There's a survivor that that I've interviewed. Her daughter is going to school to be a psychologist and wants to work with MKUltra SRA victims, you know, and she learned from her mom the truth. And now she's going to go apply it to the education system and see if she can kind of pave a way that other people aren't, you know, and it's like takes one person at a time to do something like that to where it becomes more people start looking outside their textbooks and saying, what didn't they teach me in school that I need to know?
It could take a lifetime, you know, for some people to get to that point. I know. I mean, that's so encouraging to know. And you're in St. Louis, right? Are you?
Yep.
I've been to St. Louis very briefly. I had a wonderful time just passing through St. Louis. And people were fabulous. But I have also seen up in Canada, I mean, I know of a couple of cases where an MKUltra survivor got therapy in London, Ontario, which is a huge hub for MKUltra in Canada, and yet, you know, people don't seem to know it. And she's got a therapist to come to her house who was like, you know, supposed to be helping with her, who completely denied her experience. And by the end of it caused her, Kathy, to begin to doubt, you know, and start doubt her own memories, because they're very delicate, these things, you know, these horrific childhood, infancy, you know, from infancy, things are horrible. She had some really horrible things happen to her. And she'd been getting support from a group of Americans. You know, she'd gone to the conference some of the really big names of, you know, 30 years ago, the first people to expose this, like Claudia Mullen and Blanche Chabusty, and there were any other names. She knew those people. And they had supported her, but once she was back in London, Ontario, this heavily psychiatrized community, I mean, they have hospitals coming out of, they have psychiatrists coming out of the woodwork there. And she began calling me a conspiracy theorist, you know, after, because she just didn't trust herself anymore. She didn't trust it. And that was very, you know, that's quite depressing. I don't think we're anywhere near where you are in Canada. I think Canada is really backward in this, you know. So
there's a long way to go, you know, and one person at a time. And it might take generations, but at least we're starting to see some therapists and some counselors, and there's books being written, you know, and people caring. And it's like that makes me excited that in a, you know, a couple or a few generations, hopefully they have a lot more knowledge, more widespread and mainstream than we have now.
Yeah. And look how, I'm sure it's changed your life, you know, and really opened and probably didn't take that long. Might have taken you a year or two to sort of, or less even, to take it in, to begin to really get an understanding. You have a lot, you have a deep understanding of it, I think.
It's been so helpful getting to do this. That was one thing, like I wanted to start a podcast so I could have one spot where people could go to meet people like you and to hear from Kathy O'Brien and to have like a library. But one of the things that I didn't realize was how beneficial it would be for me. You know, I've heard so many stories over the last 2.5 years, and it has, like, it was so hard for me to understand. Like, I go back to some of my really early interviews and I had no idea how to respond to any of this stuff. It just was so out of my, you know, my lane of thinking. And it still is, like, I can't fully comprehend it, but I get it. Like, I understand the science behind it and I understand the motive behind it. Even if I don't get how people can do it, it's like I see a big picture now of what the goal was and is, and I can see it in the world being, you know, amplified over the entire world instead of just, you know, at a college or in one spot. They're taking that information and now, you know, exploiting the public, you know? So I think, you know, these stories really are helpful. Like, it helps so much hearing from you and getting that breakdown of your experience. So people like me can say, Oh, Anne seems brilliant. She doesn't seem like a conspiracy theorist. Like, she's really smart, and what she said makes sense, you know? And it kind of normalizes the conversation because it's been, unfortunately, like MK Ultra, you know, it's like how you said, it's not properly portrayed. When you do hear about it, it's like this extreme, you know, way that it's presented. It doesn't sound normal. Like, it's not a way, it's not like, you know, sitting in a classroom and hearing a teacher where somebody can take it in and say, oh, you know, that sounds logical or it makes sense. It's almost exploited in a way where people just write it off right away. They're like, that's too weird. I don't even want to look at it. Where if they listen to a podcast like this and just hear two people talking, it doesn't sound so crazy anymore when you just hear the stories and how it connects and you do research on the people, you know, somebody goes and researches the doctors that you talk about in the school, and all of a sudden it's like, maybe that could happen. Like, it doesn't sound so crazy anymore, you know?
Yeah, the more we know, I mean, the more we know, the less we know. But I think when you hear someone's story and when they can connect, you know, when they can connect it all chronologically and show there's a logic to, there's like a, it's almost like it's inevitable the way things developed. You know, they decided they wanted to, you know, control people's minds and prepare people for a future where warfare would be like everywhere. That was, I think, you know, bringing warfare home to domestic populations. And then, oh, well, this, how would you do it? Well, they just went about doing it in all these, you know, taking all the people, the populations, and the people that they could get, you know, who were vulnerable, who couldn't protect themselves, the children. It's just what you would do if you were a mad scientist with a lot of money, military background, and not much, no compassion, or, you know, anyway.
Absolutely. Yes. And so I'm so grateful for you and all the work that you've done. And you
Thank
talked
you.
about your book. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about your blog, talk about some of the stuff that you're working on and maybe anything that you have coming up or just where people can aside from your book, where people can connect with you and see the work that you've been doing over the years.
Well, I'm sort of working on new fresh blogs right now, and they're like sort of only semi-public. I'm sort of doing them, it's like my place to write, and I share with a few people. And I have, and one of them is really, I'm trying to finish my story about Leonard Cohen. I have a little memoir that I published a few years ago called The Man Next Door about Leonard Cohen, and I just wanted to, it really wasn't finished, but I felt like I want to put this out there. That's kind of how it's been. I felt like someday I'll complete this work, but right now I don't want to just be living in my own little world. So that's why I have a blog, so I can kind of, you know, there's people that stumble on it or people that find it, and they learn bits and pieces of things, and then sometimes I, you know, they write to me. And one of my blogs is called Mother of Darkness. I'll give you the URL for that. But that's kind of been frozen now. I was. It seems like they've cracked down on it or something. So I can't add to it. It's kind of. But it's. There's a lot of material on it if you skim down. And eventually, I think I'll just reorganize. Take it and put it in some other form. But like stuff about Dr. I have a few articles on Dr. Mengele, and also hit. Well, Dr. Mengele coming to Quebec, experimenting on children in Quebec, you know, of the famous, the notorious, the infamous Dr. Joseph Mengele of Auschwitz fame, right? Was brought to America by the Vatican, and one of the first places he came was Quebec because it was controlled by the Vatican. And he probably worked briefly for McGill. It's all hidden, you know, it's all been hidden. So I have that kind of material. That's some really great material on that blog. But you have to kind of scroll through it. And I should be, you know, I should be reorganizing it and putting it out there more. There's some stuff on Leonard Cohen on that blog too, things I found out about him, his CIA connections, you know, the fact that he had a double. I've one this one of my favorite pieces now. I stumbled on photos that show that in 1961, Leonard Cohen had a double, an actor playing him, and they were creating some sort of alibi situation, you know, same for Lee Harvey Oswald. There were two Lee Harvey Oswald, same era, you know, and CIA, you know. So I found proof that Leonard Cohen had a you know, double, yeah, life, basically. Well, was, you know, one on a Greek island and the other while he was in Cuba, you know, fighting Castro for the CIA. So that sort of thing on that blog. There's really a lot of good information in there.
And that's Mother of Darkness. And
I'll send you the link. Maybe you could post it. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes for everybody. Yeah. And are you on social media at all?
On Facebook as Ann Diamond. I can't tell you the exact, but you know, Ann Diamond on Facebook. I'm one of 27 of them, or I don't know how many now. But I'll send you links. Also, I'm very involved in I have a site that's for survivors of these experiments, mostly Montreal survivors. There's another site that I sometimes help with called Brainwashing Victims of the Canadian Government. And so, you know, that's a really good site. Someone is doing a great job of editing that right now. And okay. So I'll send you those links to places where you can, you know, people can. I have those books. I have a few books, and lulu.com is my bookstore.
Okay. And I'm happy to link that to you so people can go down. I always say on the show, you know, we're so conditioned as a society to just go throw money at nonprofits. And sure, you can, you know, you can find a diamond in the rough nonprofit that is doing good, but more often than not, the ones that we donate to, you know, they're paying their salaries and they're not doing much with it. And I always say, go give directly to a survivor, purchase their work, you know, support their blog, go follow them on social media. Like, that's a really good investment to do that, because you know exactly where your money's going. It's not funneled through a third party. There's no commissions that are being taken out. I mean, of course, things like Amazon, like, they're going to take some money out, but I mean, ultimately, like, it's going
to be giving to Amazon. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I love when people go support, and I love when people, you know, write me and say, oh, I went and bought Anne's books, you know, and they changed my life. So I really encourage people listening, please, 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 please go support. You know, it's so generous that Anne takes the time out to do something like this for free for us. And she's been doing free, you know, with her blog and everything and just speaking out for 20 years. You know, and she puts out a book and it has all the information in one spot that we could ever want. And it's a really special thing to have something like that, that you can have at home. And it's a great gift to give to maybe a friend who's waking up, you know, to say, I don't know how to talk about this and I don't feel qualified to, but here's a book for you to read that's going to explain the stuff that I've discovered, you know, that I think you should know. And it's, you know, I think one person at a time, you know, if we start supporting survivors' work and we start hiring survivors and we start, you know, reading their blogs and following their podcasts, like, then we start creating an industry and we give you guys the resources to keep doing what you're doing. This stuff isn't cheap, even having a podcast. You're taking time out of your day right now, you know, all the time that you take to write your blogs, like, you're putting it out for free, but there's an expense on your end of time and energy. So I think it's beautiful when you create something that we can reciprocate and give you something back for it. So I encourage everybody to go buy all of your stuff and to go support you. And I'll find the real Facebook for you, and I'll just link your direct Facebook in the bottom to you. That way people find you right away.
Perfect. That's beautiful. What a wonderful speech. You're very good at this.
Oh, you're so sweet.
Another thing I would say too, though, that I've been thinking about lately is that people really need to come together around this whole subject. It's a history topic, and there should be courses given on it. I don't know if there are anywhere at universities or adult education centers or whatever, you know, so people could come together. Because when I discovered this, the world of MKUltra, I was ready to read day and night. I was so riveted to it. It explained everything, and it helped some. It was so helpful. And also, you know, it answered all kinds of questions. And I felt like I hadn't found a subject in years that had, you know, captured my attention the way this does. And I've never found anything since, except I kind of like the history of rock and roll interests me now, the history of music and my, you know, but that's, you know, we should be studying these things in universities, finding out about it. Because it happened to all of us. I believe it's not just a few survivors that had this happen. It's a whole society, really.
It's a whole society, yes. It helps you, you know, it helps everybody pull themselves out of this, you know, manufactured reality and just be able to see the world for what it is and be able to just be more conscious instead of being, you know, just so robotic like how they want us and depressed and sad. You know, it's like, wait a minute. I'm depressed and sad because my government and my TV are making me this way. When I'm out in nature for 5 days without my phone, I don't even know anything's wrong, you know? So it's like, we have to really realize that the world is bad, yes, but it's also very beautiful, and we can create the world that we want together instead of just succumbing to the world that they've created for us and saying, I guess I'm just going to be depressed my whole life. We can say, wait a minute, we're going to come together and reclaim our world, and we're going to create beautiful, you know, blogs and podcasts and books and movies. We're going to do it. We're not going to depend on Hollywood and the government to do it. We're going to create the beautiful world that we want, you know, and I think we're not there yet, but the more people learn about MKUltra, I think that's really what it does, is it helps us reclaim our power back and helps us realize, you know, what we can do if we all come together versus being so divided, like how they've wanted us to be.
Yeah. And the way we'll learn is by finding out where we've been, you know, that's how you find out how to create the future. So anyway, I encourage everyone, listen to your show, support survivors, and support you. I mean, it seems you're doing an amazing job. So I'm going to tell everyone about your show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you. It's an honor to have you on. You're such a bright light, and it's so awesome to see your smiling face and to just get to actually meet you finally.
And likewise.
Is there any closing thoughts that you have or anything that you want to say before we start closing up for the day?
No, I don't know. I feel sort of you've done a great job of wrapping it all up. I've talked a lot. You know, there's always going to be more. But I just hope that, I just keep doing what you're doing and don't stop, because I think this is the key to so much. It's like the key that will unlock all the secrets, you know, and we have it now.
Yes, we have to take our power back in.
We'll do it.
Well, okay. I will link all of your stuff below. And for people listening, no matter what platform you're on, Spotify or Apple or YouTube or BitChute, just go into the show notes, really easy. And then all the links should just highlight for you. So you can literally just click it. So please go support Anne, get her book, go follow her on social media. I'll have all of that link below. Reach out to her, tell her she's amazing, because she is, and go support her. Let her know she's loved and that we have eyes on her. And thank you guys for supporting this show. You know, it means the world to me. I always say I didn't realize when I started this that it would be just so impactful for me and then for a lot of you. And it's still such a little show, but having all of your support means the world to me. And I know it's before its time. And my hope is years down the road, it's a really valuable resource for people to learn about the world from people like Anne. So please share this episode, subscribe, support us. I also have my links below so you guys can go follow me on social media. And I really appreciate your guys' support. So with that being said, thank you guys. God bless you. And we will see you next week.